Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
To Front Three, we got the weekly podcast here. It's good to have you, people of all ages, join us on this podcast, and that's why we can also integrate the youth of Chris Hennage. Chris, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And the age and wisdom of Nico.
I think that's on the other side of the podcast, but thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Boltwood's not here. And so this week we get onto your cues and your age, your views and your news. Today there is quite a bit of news, actually. Let's get down to it first of all, though. Nico, in terms of Man City, they're having a great season so far. Not only do they seem to be storming away with the league points-wise, they've also been putting in some dominant performances. And now the 15-win run that they've gone on is record-setting. Do you think this indicates there's something for me that seems quite monumental about it for the club, because it's doing something that it hasn't done in the past, which is leading the way in so many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in your mentioning of the 15 win streak for Manchester City, it's another milestone amongst the many in the past couple of years of the club trying to elevate their status. You know, they didn't just want to be another successful English club. They knew they had to do, I think, something exceptional to do that. And that includes, being dominant in the league. That includes consistent involvement in the Champions League and success in the Champions League. And I think, results and statistics and all these things, they're a way that we sort of quantify, the real world and observe things in the real world. And I think Manchester City want to be, obviously with the 15 game streak, and it may continue to 16 or may stop here. But, at least at the very least, like I said, this is another milestone for them to come across and say, this is what we've achieved thus far. This is what we've achieved because of the investment, not only in this squad currently and in bringing a manager of the quality of Pep Guardiola, but also, just elevating the status of a club. When you look back in the records of the Premier League in 100 years from now, you'll say, there are not going to be too many teams that will have gone past 15 wins or achieve that success, because it's extremely difficult.
We can't believe they gave the league away from that position. It's incredible. of course, Chris, the long-term context in the Premier League is that for a very long time, Man City seemed like somewhat of, not a laughing stock in Manchester, possibly, but in the wider Premier League, I think a lot of people were quite fond of them. I know Liverpool fans, being a Liverpool fan, I'm quite fond of them anyway. We always had quite a sort of good repartee with that set of fans, shared a couple of players. And they were sort of the nice neighbours down the road. But this is, for me, and maybe for you as well, as someone who's sort of grown up in the Premier League era, this feels like a bit of a milestone, what's going on at Man City at the moment. And it's maybe something that we didn't consider would happen in such a prolific way at the beginning of the season, because we saw maybe a Mourinho or a Conte or a Pochettino able to pin them back in a way.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that they're leading the way. That's the difference. The Premier League titles they've secured, they weren't the first team to do that. There was no element of them forging new ground, whereas when they take records like this puts them at the top of the pile. I think any time that you have a club that and I'm careful how I phrase this, elevate themselves almost artificially through an injection of spending in the way that Man City did, in the way that Chelsea did, for example. There is an instant reaction from their rivals to point out the fact that there was nothing on the road before them, and that essentially they had no impact at the top table. And I think that's the difference for City now, is that, yes, we're looking at around a decade now of this new era of Manchester City. But when you actually talk about what they've achieved that's broken new ground, this is, to be fair, there's not a huge amount there. And I think that's what makes this so different.
Do you think maybe facility-wise, so the investment level is obviously something that's broken new ground, but maybe the investment level you could, I mean, I think it's £1 billion, whatever, close to that. That level almost felt like it was to catch up with the investment that other teams have made down the years, because they hadn't been doing it over 15, 20 years, like United or Liverpool have been, you know, wasting money. Or, you know, it felt like they needed to sort of catch the pack in a way. And now it seems like they're leading the way in such a quick fashion.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Leading the forefront of infrastructure, that's great if I'm a supporter, but I don't think that's something that, you know, you're going to argue with down the pub that, well, we have the best training ground. That's not quite the...
But you may argue, though, Chris, well, we have the best youth coming through now, or we have, you know, we have the happiest players, or, yeah, I suppose what it is one of the, maybe a pub intangible, which in very real terms does actually affect what happens. Because when a player sees those facilities, or sees that he can work with Pep Guardiola, or sees that, you know, they're going to open up his image rights to this market or that market, then you are able to use that in the pub, not the image rights, but the fact that you can acquire that player in the first place.
Definitely. I think the obvious retort to that is, oh, well, it's all money related. It's not. There's a very, I think, at times sanctimonious edge to football supporters when it comes to these kind of debates.
Absolutely.
In the sense that, say it's Manchester United, for example, the idea that they're not signing for the club because of the money or whatever, they're signing it because of the prestige, what that club represents to them growing up. And I think there's a legitimacy in that argument in some quarters, because, yeah, there will be players playing right now who did grow up watching Roy Keane, Andy Cole, Dwight York, that era of player, and were inspired to almost drop their ambitions for their playing career from watching that team and wanting to replicate that success. I think this is what makes things different, is that now City are essentially, they're building that legacy right now. And it seems perhaps bizarre to look so far forward when they haven't actually won the league. But I guarantee there will be players that come through in that next generation that will look at the Guardiola side, and even if they don't voice it publicly on record, they will see it as a point of inspiration and almost a moment of, which I think you can only do when you're a child, I want to be part of that. That's who I want to play for. That's who you dream of, and that's who you envisage yourself wearing if you're lucky enough to make it to that level.
Well, Nico, it's certainly an interesting one this weekend, because other teams have come, tried, failed against City, Liverpool, Mithrash, Manchester United, you know, pretty well beaten, I'd say. Can Spurs break that? Because there does seem to be that age-old respect between, the respect that comes from before they both came to the Premier League, between Pochettino and Pep. And there is a sort of a giant killing mentality going on at Spurs at the moment. You know, we've seen them take on the Real Madrid, even if they weren't at their very peak, and take a scalp.
Yeah, and I think, you know, along with the giant killing mentality that you're maybe mentioning, which has been consistent at Spurs for the last couple of seasons, especially with Mauricio Pochettino, I think they have the best, or they are the most tactically inclined to do so. And I think perhaps, you know, we talk about the defining moments in the season, and perhaps we can look back at the weekend prior and say, you know, that was a real defining game. But I think another one was the red card to Sadio Mane to a Liverpool team that I think is perfectly posed to as well provide threats to City in ways that they, you know, they're uncomfortable with. And I think of the two teams that are able to dishevel a very strong Manchester City team, Liverpool and Spurs are capable of doing so. And I know David and I have had many disagreeable conversations about how one goes about doing that, but I think I genuinely believe that in certain situations, whether it be a situational or high press, I think that is the best way to get at Manchester City, because they are brilliant in the way that they possess the ball once they're in a certain phase of build-up. They are brilliant in breaking down teams that are compact in their own defensive third. What they're not necessarily brilliant at is building out of play. When they have been threatened by the likes of Arsenal, by the likes of Napoli and Shakhtar Donetsk, they have faltered. And just because it hasn't necessarily resulted in a defeat, just because it hasn't necessarily even all the time resulted in a goal, I think people are kind of willing to overlook that. And a lot of the analysis says, oh, you know, they'll just play around you. Not all the time. I think if you're consistent enough and you are maybe if someone were to approach the game in such a meticulous way that I think Mauricio Pochettino has the capability to do, then I think we could see a moment of weakness and possibly a defeat for Manchester City. At the other end of the table, there is the possibility that Manchester City, you know, just simply outscore them because of the attacking numbers that they're able to produce and the risk that is inherently involved with, you know, enacting such a high press and situational press. But I think of the teams that Manchester City have to play in the foreseeable future, Tottenham are certainly the ones that offer the most threat.
People are talking about them possibly tiring, or maybe when we find that sort of other side of Man City, do you think that they will tire?
Well, it's an interesting thing, because as I was watching the Swansea game yesterday, I almost wondered how the question popped into my head as to Manchester City play in a very positionally oriented way. You know, a lot of their positioning, the way that they put players in certain spots, tends to sort of naturally, with the formation and the movement of those players, tends to make the opposition uncomfortable. And I know the analysis right now from certain, you know, pundits or whatever is just, you know, City are in good form, City are brilliant, City have brilliant players. And that while those things might be true, you know, one thing that they did against Swansea yesterday, which Real Madrid have done in the past, is, you know, Swansea were defending in sort of a 4-5-1 or 4-4-2 formation, and they positioned three players on the outside of one flank. And when you do that, given the fact that there's really only two defensive lines of players, there is only two players on the outside. So when you have three players, Bernardo Silva, Kevin De Bruyne, and Danilo in this instance, then one of them is going to be free in those situations, and it's usually Kevin De Bruyne. So that creates an opportunity for him to either receive the ball with time and space, or receive the ball in an instance where someone is going to be open because of the quantitative inadequacies strewn around the pitch because of those positions. So I almost wondered if, because a lot of City's attack comes down to positioning, if it's less, you know, tolling on the players' bodies than maybe past champions, where the way that they broke down teams that just decided to be compact is to get in a ton of crosses and isolate players in one-on-one situations and win headers and be more proficient in those situations. And I think they might genuinely be something that City benefit from, because they need to do that, because as much depth as they have in maybe attacking or defensive positions, you need to have a little bit of luck as a team that wins the league by such a great margin, or as a team that competes across four fronts. So I think it's definitely something to look into if anybody is particularly inclined.
Well, Chris, obviously Man City thrashed Swansea earlier in the week, and one of the headlines coming out of Swansea before we came in to record this evening was that Renato Sanchez is subject to possibly ending the loan early between Swansea and Bayern Munich. I didn't get a chance to read beyond the headline, but it seems as if you know maybe a little bit more.
It's coming via a story on Mais Futebol, who are a Portuguese outlet. And yeah, in essence, it's exactly as you said, that they are looking into terminating the loan, which doesn't make a huge amount of surprise for me, because I think it hasn't been a great situation for him. I think in general, his career probably post that first season at Benfica, I mean, he signed for Bayern before this season was over. So you could argue that point. It hasn't been very well managed. Thiago Estevao, I think is how you pronounce his name, wrote a fairly decent piece recently on his situation in terms of what he needs to improve on, you know, where he was good, where he was bad, this kind of thing. But I think it was a very difficult position for him to be placed in the first instance, because he had a situation whereby Benfica, I wouldn't say they needed money, but they sensed the opportunity to make big money on a player with a lot of potential, but also a lot of rough edges at the same time. And that was probably incredibly difficult for him to turn down.
I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because obviously, it almost seems as if Renato Sanchez was destined for greatness as soon as he left the club. And I still don't know if there's a great doubt that he is destined for it. I think it was always going to be a real task to go to a club like Swansea, wasn't it? But there was a great question on Beyond the Continent podcast that I was listening to earlier today. Great podcast. You can go and listen to it from the Football Ramble. Andy Brassel, James Horncastle, all those guys. And they had a question from one of the listeners, which was that their listeners aren't as good as ours. But they basically said, if you stay in a place like maybe William Carvalho did, instead of leaving, is there almost a benefit to that? And Chris, I guess it is partly that Renato Sanchez hasn't really had a place where he's settled. And actually what he needed was a place to settle, a place where he could learn a little bit. It felt as if Bayern was going to be that move. But for some reason, it hasn't been that. And I guess maybe that makes it trickier for him, because as a young man, you do need a formative environment. And maybe Swansea's not always going to be that. When he was signed, it was sort of like, right, this guy is getting us out of trouble.
Yeah, I think, honestly, there was part of Bayern or whoever sanctioned the deal saw him as the potential replacement to Arturo Vidal eventually. And I think what has surprised me most is that Bayern didn't seek to loan him domestically. Because I think one of the things that maybe caught him by surprise was the culture of German football. Because you have to remember, there's a very different prospect playing for Benfica, where you're expected to dominate games, dictate games, and you can almost take risks without fear of repercussion. I don't know if that's the same case with Bayern Munich, because in the Champions League, you're playing better opposition. I would say domestically, the gap is maybe a little bit smaller at the same time. And so there was a lot of instances where it felt like his scope for failure was much greater. And so his ability to take risks had to be reined in. And when you do that, I would argue, reduce the effectiveness of someone like Renato Sanchez. At the same time, going to a team like Swansea, it was very much billed as Swansea getting this huge star and all this. I think you're totally right in saying he hasn't had that stable footing to be the huge star that Swansea needed. And I'm almost surprised that Swansea went for this deal as well, because to me, it seems far too risky for a player that, you know, didn't play a lot last season, and when he didn't look all that fantastic. Even the under-21s with Portugal, I watched a good amount of that tournament and a good amount of that Portugal side. And there was a game in particular, I believe it was Serbia, where for large portions, he looked very poor, very much off the pace, rusty, all this kind of stuff. And then towards the end, I had literally just hit tweet on how he was having a poor game, and he produced what was a very cute, clever pass in behind the defence that allowed Portugal to score. And I think that sort of polarising nature to his game, the duality of those two, of having a poor performance but a brilliant moment, is almost the problem that Sanchez has found himself mired in. Is that, yes, he can do these beautiful little things, but it's keeping that consistency during the 90 minutes, which for a player in central midfield, which is such an important aspect of the field, I think that's key, is the consistency over that moment of brilliance that maybe, say, a striker or a winger can survive on.
And I guess that's part of it, is actually he does seem like a fantastic player. But I think in other teams, it's also different transitions between different leagues, and also being surrounded by players who complement your style. It's interesting because, Nico, I was getting into it with Dave earlier, transitioning away from Renato Sanchez and towards someone we thought would be much closer to him positionally in the league, Burnley. You know, Dave said he doesn't particularly rate Sean Dyche as high as he is up in the table. And not that he feels that he's lucky, but maybe that this is the peak. This is peak Dyche. What Dyche has built is a very cohesive side, and a side with very defined roles, and a side which you could describe as almost quintessentially English, I guess, or English, not something to be proud of, but a sort of quintessentially English side. What do you think of the success? Because when they were up in fourth, it seemed very heady. People got very excited. We all tweeted about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that has mystified the analytics community.
Nothing mystifies the analytics community now. You all saw it coming, right? Because you all project things. Project, and then it happens, right?
Some people project, some people use analytics to go back and look at things from a regressionary standpoint, and that's the way I like to do it. But it is something that has polarized the analytics community to some extent, because some people, I think the trouble that some analysts have in viewing Sean Dyche's Burnley is that it is clear over or under performance, however you want to look at it, from his team. But he's been doing this consistently, and it's not just in the Premier League that he's done this with his Burnley side. It's when they went back down to the Championship, they overperformed their attacking numbers. They've, I think, consistently but more believably overperformed their defensive numbers. And I think it's much easier from, an eye test perspective to look at Burnley and say, okay, they defend in weird ways. They allow possession in areas that teams normally aren't comfortable with, and they're very good at defending those areas because they defend as a team. As you said, he has clearly defined roles. They have a group of players that have been together for a relatively long period of time, so they understand what they're doing, and they tend to, make their buck on block shots. The difficulty is in over-predicting or over-performing consistently the attacking numbers, which only really one other manager has consistently done so, which is Lucien Favre, who is not enjoying his time or his second season at Nice. And I think that the only explanation that I can come up with is the following, which I had discussed with a few of the guys at StatsBomb, is I think given the narrative surrounding Burnley and really the way that they play and the way that they manipulate game state to some extent with the teams that they play, is that Burnley obviously aren't a high possession team. They're not really a possession football kind of team. But given when they do get possession, I think given the current state of the game and how teams who want to dominate the ball, or teams who have the opportunity to dominate the ball in any given match, want to get it back so quickly, I think there are errors that teams make in organizing their defensive shape against a team who isn't normally possessing the ball, and so there is more to exploit there. And I also, there are explanations from great guys like James York that, you know, these guys are simply riding the overperformance, and that it will eventually regress to the mean like Leicester did. Leicester were extremely lucky in their title run, and we can all, you know, mire at the Cinderella element of it, but at the end of the day, they came back to where they were supposed to be performing. I think it's an interesting one. I think if you're so inclined to look at something that maybe quote unquote breaks analytics, then go ahead and watch Burnley and see if you have a better explanation than what's currently being offered.
It's English. It's just English. That's the key part here. You're not getting. You don't understand his English.
Clearly I don't, but I think maybe if I can give the question back to you and Chris, I mean, the thing that I think Ted Knudsen and James York were kind of talking about is, and maybe Dave was saying this as well, is this Sean Dyche's peak? Is this where he sort of tops out as a manager and says, this is the peak of what I can achieve given certain resources? Or if he does get a job, like maybe going to Everton, who have a higher quality of player, a better quality of resources, Do we believe that he can produce the same or similar overperformance with players of a higher quality? And I mean, is that down to his style? Is that down to, you know, some element of man management? I mean, what is that down to?
I mean, it's a tricky one. I guess it's sort of, there's a lot there's a lot to unpack there, because it's sort of, I guess I end up questioning what quality is in football. I think, you know, it's quite obvious sometimes that it seems unusual that, I don't know, we almost assume that a team like Burnley couldn't sign a Lewandowski or sign a, I don't mean Lewandowski now, I mean Lewandowski from back in the day, because someone else would have found them, or they can somehow make a player better. I always feel like it's unusual that people assume that somehow Sean Dyche is overachieving because of A, his level of investment, or B, the players that he has, and for some weird reason those players can't improve in some way. I understand there's an element of overachieving. You sort of get what I'm saying by that? Like,
yeah, definitely. I mean, I get what you're saying. I just think it's not just, you know, he has a certain quality of players that we're talking about overperformance. It's genuinely that they don't create as good of a chance as, or don't consistently create as good a chances as other teams tend to, and yet they are continuing to score and win games and put together performances, and it's extremely odd, because with, you know, 99.9% of the stuff that we kind of see with these things, the predictions and the performances are consistent. But with this team for a couple of years now, and with this manager, that's why it's so interesting. He seems to be doing something special.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I listened to a really good interview earlier today from Freakonomics Radio, which sometimes I don't really agree with the politics of some of their interviews, but it was quite good. And it was with basically the woman who runs the IMF, not the Impossible Mission Force, the International Monetary Fund. And she was sort of challenged with a quite interesting question, or it was more of an idea that didn't really become a question. But the idea was roughly this. Down the years, the IMF, governments, all these different people have made a lot of really good and also really bad predictions. And over time, people have come to distrust that side. And I don't know, maybe I used to sort of mock those people a little bit, because I thought, well, you know, institutions have got all these stats and history and all these sort of things. And I sort of saw the benefit of those. And I guess that now it's sort of similar in the Premier League, where the institution and all these big stats collectors and big stats models, and sort of the idea of the information must be right in some way. And certain people do push that idea online, is that their information is right. And I think very often if you're from outside the stats community, you overlook the fact that there are biases within those things. And then when something sort of goes outside of it, they go, well, it must be wrong in some way. Or they just wait for it to fail and then go, see, I told you it would be bad. And I think it's sort of overlooking, Chris, the sort of narrative side, maybe, of the way that we read data and the way that we read the world around us. And I found her answer quite interesting, because she was basically challenged with the idea of, people made predictions in the past. Those predictions were wrong. And so now we've come to mistrust elements of the authority that came with information and stats and all those things. And we've gone back to, if not a correct way of seeing things, but more of a way of, my gut tells me this and therefore I feel this way, and therefore I must be right ahead of the institution. I'm not saying that either side is right. The question is more broadly about Brexit, but I guess I'm saying something similar about what's going on in the Premier League at the moment with Sean Dyche, Sam Allardyce to some extent, maybe younger managers, not even British managers, sort of not necessarily going along the trends that we've seen in the past, and therefore it makes it harder to predict, because we're not looking for those trends.
Yes, I think something I've long thought is that there's a difference between the facts and the truth, in so much as facts can be misleading. And I think in the case of Sean Dyche, yes, I think it's good to lean on analytic statistics to look for trends as to why they are successful. Rory Smith did a good piece in the Times articulating a lot of the defensive elements of this Burnley side and why that makes them as strong as they have been, in terms of keeping clean sheets, earning narrow wins, that kind of thing. And I thought it was interesting that Mark Hughes took a slightly less statistic-heavy take in saying that really all they do is they keep it tight and then wait for the ball to bounce. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think there's more premeditation in Burnley's attack. I do think they know what they're doing when they get it into the final third. I think you look at the goal against Everton they scored at Goodison. That was actually a very well-worked team goal. I don't think that kind of goal happens by accident. But what I do think is very central to Dyche's thought process is the fact that the longer you can stay in a game and keep it tight, the more chance you have realistically of winning it. And there was, I think it was James York or possibly one of the guys at Besotted Brentford told me many years ago that Mark Warburton would often make an attacking sub late in the game if they were tying, because there was more benefit in going for the win than settling for the tie across the season. I do think Dyche has that element to him, that he knows, especially against teams like Stoke, who will come and think, you know, oh, we can get a win here or we need a win here. They'll keep trying and trying and trying. And the more they're frustrated, the more they will inevitably open themselves up, which will allow Burnley to play. I know, speaking from experience, when Newcastle went to Burnley, I left the game thinking, how did we lose that? There's no way they were markedly better than us. What they did was they made the best of the chance that they got. And I think that's the thing, is that there's an element of Burnley and Sean Dyche, which is, it's a little bit of a coin flip. It's them keeping it tight and then waiting to expose a team in that moment that they engineer. So I don't think he's some coaching innovator or anything like that. And for me, there is an air of him that reminds me a little bit of Sam Allardyce, that he can get a lot out of a team with low expectation. But let's put him in, you know, the likes of an Everton or somewhere like that, which is perhaps ironic given who their current manager is. And let's give him a good transfer budget. And then let's see what he does, and let's see how he manages to deal with that expectation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I can just piggyback off that, Chris is exactly right there in talking about things that maybe we can't quantify yet, at least with analytical measures and stuff like that, is, you know, like I mentioned with the game state sort of thing, I think a lot of teams favor themselves against the quality or the perceived quality of Burnley. So he said it exactly right. The teams open themselves up to a Burnley and create, you know, havoc for themselves on the defensive end. And maybe that's something that that Burnley is consistently capitalizing on.
In which case, well played. If certain sides can win 1-0, and play against the odds. And I also think there's an element of, with the top managers, for some reason we assume that they have a great master plan. And for a lot of the rest, so if you step outside the top four, we're sort of like, well, this guy must be an idiot. He's not working for Liverpool or Manchester United, so he can't be as clever as these guys. We just don't ascribe the same master plan to those guys. But then we do ascribe a great master plan, Nico, to Claude Puel, who is achieving what you originally thought he would at Southampton, except with Leicester. And obviously he sort of threw it in his ex's face, if you like, just the other night.
Yeah, he pretty handily won at Southampton. And I kind of feel bad for Southampton because they have, you know, been at the negative end at the negative end of some really poor finishing for a couple of seasons now, and that's something that I think Claude Puel suffered from in his one season at Southampton, is that they created enough in terms of attacking numbers and they were extremely defensively proficient, but they just couldn't finish it at the other end, and that seems to be what's happening yet again at Southampton this season. And maybe it's something with the current crop of players that they have and something not going right offensively there, but you know, I always thought when he moved to Leicester that was a really good fit for him, because given the success that a lot of those players had under Claudio Ranieri through defensive pressing and jumping on teams in that sense, Claude Puel's style matched up exactly correctly to that. And I think the meshing of a squad that was already, you know, primed to be successful with those sort of tactics in combination with a manager that I think, you know, we as you're mentioning there, if you go outside of the top six, I don't necessarily hold that opinion that, you know, managers outside the top six don't have a master plan. But I think because it's clear with Claude Puel that he puts a lot of thought into how he's going to manage his team and do certain things. And I think, you know, it was always a that if as a club, and maybe Everton should pay attention to that sort of thing, as a club, the thing that you should do as opposed to anything else in terms of getting a manager in terms of, you know, the poise, not poise, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but the stature of a manager that they need to come in and do something at the club, the best thing that you can do is find a manager that fits the best with the group of players that you have, or the majority of the players that you have. And I think that's exactly what Leicester did, because as I mentioned, they enjoyed so much success with an aggressive pressing style, and that was something that Claude Puel demonstrated that he could coach into a group of players very well at Southampton.
Let's move on, Kristen, to Syria, where there is some interesting developments in the situation with Donnarumma. AC Milan fans just the other night unfurled a banner which basically said they're sick of the games that he's playing, psychological games that he's playing, as they seem to put it, and a sign calling his brother a parasite, and they've paid him €6 million and said that it's now his time to leave the club. It's an incredibly sort of contrasted story. Just as we came on air Gabriel Marcotti tweeted, "Donnarumma situation gets messier." Goes on Instagram to say he never claimed to be a victim of moral violence, which is, I think, what the AC Milan fans were saying. He was coerced when he signed his deal, and he stopped short of saying, though, that he will stay with the club. It seems like a really unusual situation there, Chris. There's a 19-year-old who originally almost signed for Inter Milan, then went and signed for AC Milan, went and got Mino Raiola as his agent, and has since just been on an entire roller coaster of whether he's going to stay or leave. You know, we predicted on the podcast he would leave in the summer, and now it seems as if AC Milan fans have had enough.
Yep, most definitely. And I think, look, I'm not going to call the guy names. You just have to look at the situation that unfolded with him. You just look at the way things unfolded with him prior joining Milan, the whole Inter situation, how, again, that was all but signed and sealed, and then he ups and bolts and goes to Milan. I'm not saying that...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That he is a snake, or one of these buzzwords that people are using in football these days. I do think it gives you a glimpse into someone's character, and that they're focused on advancing their career at all times. The problem is the timing of this is pretty terrible if I'm a Milan fan, because their ownership continues to have this ambiguous cloud surrounding it in terms of its financing and all that stuff. And I think realistically at this point, you have to accept that the relationship as it is untenable. So you have to look at selling him. And the good thing is, goalkeepers who are, I would say, of his level, potential and actual talent as it stands right this second, are in fairly short supply. And I think there will always be a set of clubs that are eager to add someone like that to the team. So they shouldn't have trouble finding a buyer. And then they can continue to reinvest that.
Well, I guess it's sort of an interesting one, isn't it? Because actually, he's 19, he's still a very young guy, right? And he's clearly still developing in some way, but then he's also had to show a great level of maturity on the pitch. Some people maybe mistake that for what he may show off the pitch as well. Not always the case. Gattuso has obviously had to galvanize this side in some way after taking over and basically saying, I'll emotionally be better than the previous guy. That's open for debate as to whether it actually is. It's interesting because now he doesn't actually have a World Cup to compete to get into the squad for this summer. So feasibly he could move in January, stay with that club, maybe Juventus, if Buffon chooses to retire, learn a little, transition a little. What then?
In what sense?
Well, I mean, I'm only sort of putting that scenario out there that, you know, he could go to Juve. He could go to any club, sit on the bench for a while and collect a check, train, build himself back up, almost take himself away from the spotlight, reemerge as the best.
Yeah. I think the difficulty in that is that he's already sort of established it. That would, by a lot of people's means, see it as a step back. Backwards.
I mean, maybe not if you move to an institution like Juventus or you move to
That's fair. It depends very much on the club that he's moving to. And I think at the same time, he is so tremendously young. I do think he needs to be very careful with where he goes next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, we just talked about Renato Sanchez. It's very easy to tarnish, feels like the wrong word, but destabilize your reputation as a young player, as someone with potential, by making a few bad decisions. Or
especially if your attitude is not.
Yeah, this is the other thing. And in fairness, that same criticism has been leveled at Sanchez, that his attitude hasn't been perfect. Now, that to me ignores a little bit of the human element of the person, but at the same time, it all conspires together to make the situation as it is. And that's what I think Donnarumma has to do. Yes, fantastic goalkeeper, wonderful goalkeeper. I would say there are a few better, if I'm genuinely honest. I can't think of anyone better in that age bracket of, say, 17 to 21.
Maybe the Toulouse goalkeeper, I can't remember what his name is, but so it escapes me now, but yeah.
And so he is on a very privileged position right now. And that's why I think he needs to be doubly sure about wherever he goes next, what that's going to be for him and what that's going to represent. Because, as I say, it would be very easy to topple what is a promising career with a few bad decisions.
I don't see at any point Mino Raiola ever turning to one of his clients and saying, now, are you sure about this? We just want to be doubly sure that everything makes you happy. But yeah, I think you're right. I think you'd make a better agent. But then neither of us are multimillionaires. Let's talk for a second then about one of the other possible big moves of the summer, Ozil to Barcelona. It's certainly going to be interesting if this one plays out, Chris. If Liverpool don't sell Coutinho in January, they may sell him, probably will sell him come the summer. Barcelona now maybe flirting a little with the idea of Ozil because, well, he'd be a cheaper alternative to Coutinho.
He would. It's an interesting one as to how he fits in. I think, look, he's a fantastic player on his day. There is no questioning that. I do like the way that Coutinho looks in that Barcelona side. I don't know why he looks in that bloody shirt, mate. Yeah, I'm sure it's different for a Liverpool fan.
Yeah. Marino looks good in a Barcelona shirt to me.
He doesn't look much cop in a Newcastle shirt at the minute, unfortunately. Never mind a Barcelona one. But yeah, I think perhaps this is where Barcelona have to consider two things. Is it genuinely cost effective to go for Ozil in terms of will it provide a similar lifespan as to what they are hoping from Coutinho, or even to the point where they could potentially gather up the funds to then sign a replacement in a few years. And at the same time, they've made some pretty significant errors in the transfer market of late. A lot of their moves have been questionable. Some haven't been, I would say, financial sinkholes, like, say, De La Feo, but that doesn't change the fact that that's a slightly bizarre deal. And so the problem that I have with Barcelona right now is that whenever they seem to do something, I almost view it as possibly what you shouldn't be doing, irrespective of who's involved.
Well, let's go to an interview from earlier in the week. Nico, you spoke with, I'll let you tell us, who do you speak with about Dortmund and the situation there, which has been progressing this week?
Yeah, I spoke to Stefan Buschko. He writes for ESPN and ESPN Insider on Bundesliga topics. And we figured it'd be good to get him on considering Borussia Dortmund just sacked their manager, Peter Bosz. So, I talked to him about the sacking, the rumors to Julian Nagelsmann and whatnot. And it was a really interesting chat. So if you guys want to have a listen, that'll be next.
Right, go.
Stefan Buschko, we've had him on the podcast before. He writes for ESPN and ESPN Insider on Bundesliga topics as well as specifically Borussia Dortmund. We wanted to have him on again, obviously, because he's very insightful, but also there are a lot of things going on at Borussia Dortmund right now. They just sacked their manager, Peter Bosz, and so we wanted to talk to him about those kind of things. Stefan, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you very much. I already apologize for all the background noise because right now I'm not in Dortmund, actually. I thought the season in Dortmund would excuse the pun Peter out, and so many things have changed. So I'm in Philly right now, I'm in South Philly, and there are cars passing by, and they're very loud, and there are a lot of potholes, so I already have to excuse myself if there are any sirens or whatever going on in the background.
the listeners will know that they've experienced their fair share of audio issues with Lawrence going through the streets and different members of our podcast being on different parts of the world. So it's not that big of a deal, and you don't sound like you're in a busy area. But just to get onto the Borussia Dortmund chat, obviously the ironic thing about the podcast that we had recorded last time was that I think it was recorded with a more positive tone. It was sort of towards the end, or probably right at the end, of when Peter Bosz's good faith was being enjoyed by the Borussia Dortmund fans. He had obviously enjoyed a relatively good start to the season at Dortmund, and then things started to go downhill, and very downhill, very quickly. Do you have any, you know, reasoning as to why that happened, why, you know, Dortmund's results were so poor across all the competitions, and why that happened all of a sudden?
Well, I would put it like this. Dortmund were never 100% solid, even in their time until like September, where they won 6 and drawn 1 in the first league games. They were already snuffed out in the Champions League because Dortmund played a very risky style, very high aggressive pressing under Peter Bosz, a very high line, and Dortmund do not possess the defenders per se that have the individual quality to basically keep it tidy at the back well enough against fast breaking players. And there was an injury crisis at the back line, if you will, adding to it, which meant Dortmund had zero to none consistency. I think in 21 games under Peter Bosz, he had 16 different combinations or formations at the back, which tells you a lot about how patchy and makeshift it really was. But obviously, that wasn't all. But after one international break, Dortmund's schedule got a little bit tougher in the league. And things didn't really, you know, they just got found out, basically. What happened is that teams realized that a simple man marking against the entirety of Dortmund's 10 outfield players more or less would be enough to stifle their build-up play. It never really changed much overall. Since then, Bosz did not find a solution to fix that. And on the one hand, I would say Dortmund had a very good start and then got snuffed out, and Peter Bosz did not find the adjustments. And on the other hand, there was just the defensive malaise that added to it. And with injuries and players losing their form, being touch and go, it's just a very toxic cocktail that was brewing through weeks. And with every poor result, there was less and less confidence within the players, and in the end Dortmund did not manage to have a good game over 90 minutes overall. I mean, they had the 4-0 lead after 25 minutes in the Revier Derby against Schalke a couple of weeks ago, and blew it, and you know, it ended 4-4, which is basically impossible to explain if you are 4-0 up and then lose 4-4. Basically, it's the vital Revier Derby. You know, it's the one game where every Dortmund fan looks forward to, and then you blow such a lead. And I actually thought this was the moment where either Dortmund were going to sack Peter Bosch or would hold on to him, because then they had a full week and prepare for the next game against Bayer Leverkusen. And you know, Leverkusen was another interesting game. Dortmund had a very poor first half. Leverkusen were dominating them, creating a lot of chances, then eventually scored, obviously, on a fast break. And had a sending off. And then only when Leverkusen were down to 10 men, Dortmund managed to have some control and possession. So, yeah, overall, I would just say things did not click and Peter Bosch was not the right coach because he could not adapt to the playing material or player material he has in Dortmund. And Hans-Joachim Watzke, the CEO, was on a football talk show today, and he revealed, let's put it this way, that a lot of players did not have the confidence in Peter Bosch's high pressing system. And, you know, any coach in the world, be it Jürgen Klopp or I think Domenico Tedesco of the current Schalke manager, also explained it very well, is that if you want to play a very aggressive pressing, then you have to have your players to believe in it, because you have to make a lot of runs that will seem futile to the players, but you know, they help obviously to gain possession. But as soon as it's not 100% working, as soon as a player is 1 yard off or the pressing impulse just starts too late, we all know what happens. Then there are spaces the opponents can play into because the pressure is not fully working. And as soon as that happens, everything collapses and you are wide open at the back and will eventually be picked apart. And this is what consistently happened against Dortmund. And yeah, if Dortmund players do not have the faith in the idea of the coach, and the coach has not the, I don't know, let's just say he's a little bit stubborn. He's a Dutch manager after all, and he didn't want to really adjust his style of football, although in the later stages of his tenure at Dortmund, he actually, yeah, it was a little bit more conservative, his approach, but overall not enough for him to save his job. And I think now Dortmund bringing in Stöger is actually a good idea.
Do you think that perhaps, I know you're mentioning a lot of, you know, maybe the transition and things that he could have done better, but do you feel as though he wasn't given enough time? Because, you know, as we're talking about it, this was, you know, it wasn't like it was his second year, or he wasn't even fully or halfway into the season. This was sort of a quarter way, if not a little bit farther than that, into the season, where they felt he wasn't the right man, the man for the job anymore. Do you feel like it was too soon, or are you part of the, I guess, train of thought that believes that the sacking was completely justified and perhaps he was never going to be the right coach from the beginning?
Well, I don't know. I'm always sitting on the fence on these matters, because I'm not one to you know, dictate as a journalist. I'm not one to write, well, Peter Bosch has to go now, or Borussia Dortmund have to hold on to him. I always try to understand the way of thinking of the club, and in this way I can understand why they let him go. As I already explained, the team apparently did not have the faith in this idea, and at this point, I guess at this point it's just a time to let him go. On the other hand, you know, if you look at it in the bigger picture, Borussia Dortmund usually enter every game as a favorite in the Bundesliga, and you have to play possession football and you have to be very aggressive. Bayern Munich do it all the time and they do it very well, and usually Dortmund should do the same. So a coach with the profile of Peter Bosch, who does exactly that, press very high and very aggressively, and wants to implement a very entertaining style, basically, is exactly what Dortmund's officials were looking for in a coach. And so the appointment, you know, from the outset actually made a lot of sense to me. So, yeah, but, you know, there was no real development. There was not a curve, not a trend where you would say, yeah, things are starting to improve again. I don't know. Dortmund were just in free fall. And I think the last game against Bremen was then also that was just so catastrophic that you didn't really think that, you know, he could turn things around at all, because Dortmund were completely lackluster in the first half. And it was followed by a very interesting rant by team captain Marcel Schmelz after the game. I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but he basically said, yeah, now it's time for us to pull our heads out of our behinds. And said, you know, it was an absolute impotence how the team performed. And so you could just see, you know, Dortmund in eighth place at the time had to turn things around for themselves. They play at home to the 17th team in the Bundesliga, which is second to last. So you would think that they would give their all to, you know, turn their malaise around, but they did not. They were just completely lackluster. They were timid. They had zero shots or zero chances in the first half. And yeah, in the second half, they actually had like a 15-minute period where it looked like they could play football, where they pressured Bremen, where they pinned them at their own box and then eventually equalized. But, you know, after that, they once again put the foot off the gas and yeah, Bremen won the game in the end and Dortmund had no response. And at this point, I mean, Peter Bosz in this first half, for instance, changed his formation or his system three times. He started like with a 4-3-3, then switched to a 4-2 or I think to a 5-2-3, and then ended with a 3-4-3 system. But it doesn't really matter at this point, because no system in the world will help you if the players just don't really show the willingness to do what they're supposed to. And I think at this point, you know, with all the observation and data you have, I guess as club officials, you have to come to the conclusion that things are not working out. And there are also rifts within the team off the pitch, apparently, you know, when you read between the lines what the officials say and what Schmelzer said himself, you get a good idea that, you know, not all is well in the Dortmund camp. He basically referred to Bremen as a very good example where players are helping each other out on the field, and that, you know, strikers are making runs so, you know, they can beat their markers. And Dortmund did not do that. There were zero runs to beat a simple man orientation. You know, all you have to do is move a little bit around, you know, to simplify it. And, you know, at this point, you can already get a feel for that, you know, there are tensions within the squad. And, yeah, I don't think Peter Bosz found a solution to do that. And, you know, when Peter Stöger was appointed, you know, there was a lot of talk at this press conference about his empathy and his skills to maybe unite a team. And I think this is, you know, another component that Bosz lacked in the end, that he just didn't have the sufficient people skills, let's say. Although he's a very, very calm, very gentle manager, took a lot of time to talk to his players. You know, there's not a lack of, you know, work from him. I don't know. He's a very good manager. It just didn't work out for him at Dortmund. Let's put it this way.
Obviously, you mentioned there that Peter Stöger has come in and taken charge of, you know, taking the reins at Dortmund. Is he seen at Dortmund as more of a caretaker manager until they are able to get a replacement and that maybe is more suited to their aspirations? Or is this something that you think can go the long haul or be long term, as perhaps Bayern Munich are finding out with their supposed caretaker manager, Jupp Heynckes?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because Peter Stöger only got a contract until the end of the season. So, you know, there are a lot of rumors that say that Dortmund already have Julian Nagelsmann, who is the current Hoffenheim manager, lined up as their long-term solution. And obviously that move in itself would make a lot of sense. Julian Nagelsmann, also a coach that knows how to play possession football, what Dortmund in the end need. Obviously, Peter Stöger is also a coach who can do that. Maybe not with Cologne, But he did so when he won the Austrian League with Rapid Vienna over Salzburg back then, which was also quite an achievement. But I don't know. You know, Dortmund just appointed him a couple of days ago. They had one game. Obviously, they won it. But it's too soon to really say what the way of thinking behind there is. But obviously, for now, they just want to stop their free fall and finish in the top four and then see what's what. I mean, the way Dortmund's officials, Hans-Joachim Watzke and also sporting director Michael Zorc are, I would say if they see that Peter Stöger is a long-term fit for Dortmund, I don't think they would rule a contract extension out at some point. But first, Dortmund have to, you know, achieve the turnaround and comfortably qualified for the Champions League. I think this is at least what Stöger has to do now. And we'll see.
You mentioned there that that Julian Nagelsmann has been sort of in the rumor mill with being linked. He was linked to the Arsenal job. He was linked to various Premier League jobs and different jobs really around Europe. But now we're seeing connections with him in Dortmund. Do you think, given the fact that this is a manager that has been over the past year because of his success with Hoffenheim, been linked with as many clubs, even Bayern Munich, that's a realistic goal for Dortmund to go out and get someone of his stature, or perhaps they're looking for someone else? Do you think that the Nagelsmann rumors are true and that's a genuine type of football and type of manager that they want to go out and get, or is this just fodder for the tabloids, as it were?
No, I would say there's some legs to that rumor. Nagelsmann, definitely a coach Dortmund have their eyes on. And Nagelsmann is also a coach that is very likely to not coach for another season at Hoffenheim, who wants to make the next step in his career. And, you know, if you interpret the whispers correctly, Thomas Tuchel is very much not locked in at Bayern, but he right now is the front runner to take over after Jupp Heynckes, although nothing is sealed over there as well. And Julian Nagelsmann obviously already more or less offered himself to take over as Bayern manager. But if that doesn't work out, which I think it won't right away, because, you know, he is still very young and Bayern will probably look for a more experienced coach with a little bit more pedigree, then there's a very good chance that Dortmund can sign Nagelsmann. After all, they were already trying to get Nagelsmann and recruit him before he was appointed head coach at Hoffenheim. So Dortmund knew for a very long time about the qualities of Julian Nagelsmann, and Nagelsmann knows for a very long time that Dortmund has a very honest interest in him, let's put it this way. And maybe there's a relationship that can be built. I mean, they definitely have communicated in the past. I'm very sure about that. So I wouldn't rule it out, let's put it this way. So
some of the more analytics based listeners might bring up a name that has been consistent with the Borussia Dortmund job for maybe a couple of years now. Lucien Favre has been in talks, or supposedly in talks, with Dortmund in the past. Obviously,
no, definitely. I mean, Nice at the time even issued a statement that he will not join Borussia Dortmund but stay on. So
very, very concrete links. Do you think now, given the fact that Peter Bosz has not worked out and maybe he's in his second year with Nice and things aren't going as well as perhaps the first year did, there could be an avenue in which Lucien Favre finds his way to Dortmund?
Yeah, I mean, he was the number one candidate for Dortmund, I would say, on the list to replace Thomas Tuchel. So I can definitely see that, but I don't know if Dortmund really want Favre as a long-term manager, because if I were Dortmund, I would rather pick Nagelsmann over Favre, because Favre has a very long and prominent history to have a falling out at a club. He is not the easiest guy to deal with. Obviously, he's a very good coach and he can do wondrous things over a certain period of time, but with Favre, you never have the feeling that, you know, going into the third or fourth season or so, there, you know, his curve is still, his strength is still going up, but rather someone who plateaus. So I think we're seeing the same thing with Nice right now, even though I'm not close enough to really know what the circumstances are that they are plummeting so badly in a French division.
I think a consistent theme that probably you're tired of talking about as someone that is asked a lot of questions about Dortmund, but nonetheless is probably a relevant question, is obviously the talent at Dortmund is seen as something that's probably some of the best in Europe and is consistently picked off by some of the bigger teams in Europe, like Bayern Munich, like Manchester City, like, you know, Manchester United, whatever.
Barcelona,
Barcelona. Do you feel as though if Dortmund do not have all their ducks in a row by the time the summer comes around, that there could be a larger exodus than perhaps they want in terms of their talent?
I mean, the thing is, for a club like Dortmund, Champions League is the key to attract talent. And as soon as this is gone, they will obviously struggle to keep talent on. I'm not only thinking about the Pulisics in the world, because I'm pretty sure he will stay at least for another season because Dortmund just need him. But I'm thinking more of a player like Marco Reus, for example, or Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. So it's not only just about the young, bright, shiny talents, but it's actually more about key players that Dortmund have to, you know, they have to have something to offer besides, you know, money, which is obviously not competitive against the bigger teams in Europe. So, you know, at least it has to be Champions League football and being somewhat competitive in the Bundesliga. And for them, it's very important to, yeah, give players that sort of feeling that things can continue. I mean, we can talk about Julian Weigl, for example, right now, because under Peter Bosz, he was used as a midfielder who had to, as a holding midfielder who had to go up front a lot of times. And so Julian Weigl is very good. He's excellent at staying very, very deep, basically just in front of the back line and just shifting the ball from left to right in a very quick fashion, and hence basically recycling possession, if you want, for Dortmund. And this way, you know, the ball is moving faster than the opponent can shift their lines from left to right. And, you know, as a possession-based team, it's very important if you have the ball a lot that you can create those gaps. And Julian Weigl is the sort of player that does this for you. And this is his main strength. And Peter Bosz took that from him. And Weigl came off an injury. He wasn't in good form right away. And basically what happened is that he lost all his pros, let's say, and we saw all his weaknesses basically magnified. You know, he's not the best when it comes to defending, tracking back and tackling, maybe also not his forte. And first game under Peter Stöger, and Julian Weigl plays the way he played in the way he became a national team player under Thomas Tuchel. And this is very important for players as well, and which I hope that Stöger can actually do, that they all play to their own strengths, and that you know, they don't feel pushed out of the club like Weigl probably would have had if Bosz had stayed on. So yeah, this is another positive after one game at least for Dortmund, that a key player like Weigl, who they think is the future for Dortmund in that midfield, maybe has a change of thought, because I think he was already contemplating a move away.
And finally, I think maybe perhaps you already answered this, but you mentioned, you know, some of the aspirations now that Dortmund have gone through maybe this more traumatic experience at the beginning of the season. What is the hope that, or I guess, what is the most optimistic goal that Dortmund can strive for in terms of success this season? I think you mentioned that Champions League is a major factor, not only, you know, just in terms of short-term success, but long-term success for the club in attracting talent and keeping the club where it needs to be in terms of, you know, the financials and all those things. But is there any maybe hope of success, whether it be in the League Cup or now that you've dropped into the Europa League or anything like that, now that maybe Bayern Munich have established a 10-point lead at the top of the table and maybe are unreachable?
Yeah, I mean, the title race in the Bundesliga is over. Bayern Munich have already won it. I think that much is clear by now. Well, the thing is, if Dortmund have a good winter, I mean, the winter break is relatively short, but if they can stabilize under Peter Stöger and don't play as suicidal as they did beforehand under Bosch and get results again. I mean, all they have to do is improve their defending. Their attack is still the best or second best now after Bayern Munich play today. I don't know. They actually might be on par. But point is, their offense is as good as any in the Bundesliga, and they don't really have to worry about it. It's just for them, it's important that they don't chip as many goals. And as soon as that is fixed, Dortmund can aspire, for example, to win the EuroLeague. I think right now, looking at how the team plays, it's still very far-fetched, but you never know, because there is a lot of quality in the squad, and you know, with a couple of changes, I wouldn't rule it out. And Dortmund play away to Bayern Munich next week in the cup, and if they win that game somehow, I don't know, it's Dortmund have done it time and time again in the recent years where they were not informed, traveled to Munich in cup games and somehow got away victorious, and they have been in the cup final for the last five seasons consecutively. So obviously this can also happen, and second place right now is only 4 points away. So ideally Dortmund finish second in the Bundesliga and make it very far in the EuroLeague. You know, everything of course can happen in a German Cup where you can make the semifinals or so. But overall, I think it's just very important to give players more aspiration about, you know, that Dortmund is still an ambitious side and not just some mid-table team that occasionally plays for a title, but is actually going somewhere. And you know, with a strong Europa League run, this is achievable. I mean, the EuroLeague is the only trophy Dortmund are yet to win in club history, so it's something to aspire. But maybe before we end, a couple of words on Peter Stöger. I think you have this question maybe written down. What he actually has done in 2 days with Dortmund is that he has opted for a more conservative approach. Dortmund did not apply that high press as they always did under Peter Bosch. They, you know, had a midfield press, a little bit more conservative. Players were not, or the back line was not as exposed as it usually was. Obviously, they still committed some tactical and individual mistakes as they always do, because there is a lack of defensive quality at the back a little bit. But overall, that already looked more... I don't want to say solid, but Dortmund just make the impression that they play a little more risk averse, and I think this can help them in the long term. And Julian Weigl, as I already mentioned, for example, is more involved again. And overall, Stöger is a coach that is very good at beating man marking schemes. He has showed that in Austria, and he has showed that with Cologne, that with a little bit more time on a training ground, he can create a lot of fluidity up front. And if Dortmund manage to do that, they are going to be a side that's hard to defend, because they have a lot of versatile players up front who can play in many different positions. Just think of Christian Pulisic, for example, who can play on either position. Andrei Yarmolenko is similar. There's Shinji Kagawa, Mario Götze, and Marco Reus obviously will return at some point. And Peter Bosch was a coach where he wanted his players to be very strict and very disciplined in their positioning, and there was very little room for fluidity. So overall, as far as I can picture it, Dortmund will improve under Peter Stöger, just because he has identified the weaknesses of Dortmund, which is in the defensive department. Give more cover to the defensive players. Maybe Dortmund will sign another center back or so this winter break. I'm sure they, if they're smart, they will add a little bit more individual quality there, and then we'll see where things are going. But you know, at this moment in time, I think he is the right coach because of his empathy levels that he certainly has, and already also showed at Cologne. And he is a very pragmatic manager. And if you go to ESPN FC, you will read about him talking about how he thinks about his philosophy there, because I transcribed a couple of quotes in the press conference, and it was very interesting because he says, well, I didn't think up any philosophy or vision as a coach that I want to enforce, because you always depend on the players and what they can implement. And I think for Dortmund, that right now is just is the right approach, because you know, their initial approach would be to be a possession heavy team and to press high, but they showed that they can't do it, and they showed that they are not even believing in this sort of system under Bosch, the sort of players. So yeah, I would say that, again, to round it off, Stöger should be the right coach, but obviously he had just one game against a very poor Mainz side, which was a 2-0 win. But yeah, I can't really make a prediction now if Dortmund really turn their fate around, or if they're just going to peter out on like fifth place or so. We'll see about that.
Well, we'll see. Thank you again for coming on to the Front Three. Do you have anything you'd like to plug to the people? They can go, like you said, they can go check out your work on ESPN.com and ESPN Insider. You have some things that you've written about the new coach, but anything else that you'd like to push forward, you're more than welcome to.
Yeah, sure. I will take the opportunity, and I will say, if listeners want to hear more about Borussia Dortmund, I am the host of the Yellow Wall Pod, English language Borussia Dortmund podcast. We air once a week, and a team of very analytical guys. So so everything you have heard from me today, you will hear just, you know, better by others.
it's one of the only English speaking Borussia Dortmund pods, and it's very, very insightful. So I do recommend that people go out and listen to it, because I always enjoy it when I do listen to it, even though I don't get to watch the Bundesliga that much. So thank you once again, Mr. Buschko, for coming on, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thank you. And I got to say, it wasn't that much background noise other than my dog running circles around me in the last 5 minutes or so. But yeah, thanks again for having me on, and until next time.
Great expectations. It's not all I hoped for. Nico Morales interviewing yet another journalist on the Front Three. Good to have you with us tonight, guys, or today, or this evening, or this morning, depending upon when you're listening. Now it's time to get into the Q's and the A's. We asked for them only an hour ago, maybe two now, and we have in their tens. Chris, your thoughts on this? Realistically, how long do you think Poch will stay at Spurs? Without Adam Boltwood here, let's discuss this anyway. Could he actually end up being a Wenger-esque figure? New stadium, young team, etc., etc. That one comes from Raybax.
Wow, that's a good question. I don't think he could stay as long as Wenger. That's, to me, that feels almost impossible in the current climate. I do think he has at least 3 or 4 more years in him. That for me is the most exciting aspect of Spurs, is how they move forward, because one of the things they've done is punched above their weight by signing, you know, Danny Rose, Dele Alli, people like that under the radar, and then developing them into these stars. I wonder if there comes a point where Pochettino decides, actually, you know what, I want to buy some stars, I don't want to make them anymore. And I think if he does, that could be one of the moments where he decides to move on to pastures new. But I think Daniel Levy is very aware that he has appointed a number of managers, but none have made him look nearly as good as Mauricio Pochettino has.
Yes, that's a very good point. It's partly not just dependent upon Poch, though you would say a huge part of it is obviously dependent upon him. Does he see that potential? Also, how long is that life cycle? One of his great mentors was Bielsa, and his life cycle's incredibly short.
I think it's different for him, though.
For Bielsa? Yeah, obviously Pochettino.
For Pochettino.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be ridiculous to say they were the same.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think he's tactically inspired by Bielsa, but I think, you know, for me, it's clear that Pochettino is emotionally invested in the project at Tottenham, and I think it's really his time there is entirely dependent upon what happens. I think he's very optimistic about keeping the essential parts of that project: Toby Alderweireld, Harry Kane, to some extent Dele Alli, and to some extent Christian Eriksen. I think the spine of that team, if that's what we're going to call it, is largely dependent on those players. And I think, like I said, he is confident in keeping a lot of those guys. But, you know, if players do start to split, if, you know, something does start to happen, if the, you know, the offers are too great for someone like Harry Kane to not refuse them, then I think his time there will come to an end shorter than he would have liked it to. But I think in his mind right now, as Chris says, I think it's impossible for someone to stay at a club as long as Arsene Wenger has in the modern game. But I think he has a long-term project that he wants to see out, and it will put Tottenham in a very different place than they are even now. And I think he won't really be happy until he achieves that.
And of course, Wanyama or something like that, fairly key to the spine of that team. Anyway, if you would have milk thrown at you, what would your preference be, Chris? That one comes from Ollie Shep. Great question.
Almond milk.
Almond milk, brilliant. Lactose intolerant, of course.
No, just healthier.
Good, brilliant. You're not going for oat, sort of oat-based milk. You can also get coconut milk.
Won't spoil either. That's worth knowing for the poor person who has to clean up the excess spillage.
How long are you planning on leaving it? My almond milk does spoil. Your almond milk spoils, Nico. Are you buying almond milk?
It's got an expiration date on it.
Ah, yes, but expiration date is bullshit. Yeah, there's just... Brilliant.
Is that like someone who's never been dirt poor?
Yeah.
It's just a test. It's a challenge.
That's just a guideline. It reminds me of my student days. Nico, what kind of milk?
I have to go with the almond milk as well, because I am actually somewhat lactose intolerant.
Somewhat. I'd have to go with a sort of frothed milk. Froth milk and warmed milk definitely smells even worse when it goes.
But is
out.
It like 2%? Is it like the thick stuff, like whole
milk?
No,
it's semi-skimmed. Although, you know, ideally you want skimmed milk, because skimmed milk is, you know, it's essentially water. It's white water. You know what I mean? And it's very different in England, by the way. Skimmed milk, as Chris will attest, is just water, isn't it, Chris?
Yep.
Yeah, pretty much. Great. Who would you want to throw it over you?
I was going to say Ashley Graham, but that sounds dodgy. I've got no idea. I mean, in theory, this is stemming from an argument, isn't it? So in theory, whoever is my greatest nemesis.
Oh, I'd like Jurgen Klopp to do it, not because I want him
so
to
Dave,
be my...
I mean,
Dave would definitely be a good one. Although I think when it came to them throwing the milk back at Dave, Dave would go, but I've got a few things that I can't do, so you can't throw that milk over me. And we'd go, Dave, you can't renege on me throwing milk over you. And he goes, but can I? And then it goes on for 9 months, and ultimately he's still not got blonde hair. Who would you have it? The only reason I want Jurgen Klopp is because I think he'd instantly apologise as well. So he'd sort of do like he did with the journalist, where he sort of goes, milk, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. Great, see you later. And then he's gone. Nico, who do you want to throw it over you?
Oh, all the people at the Dairy Council think.
I think having loving the words this week. Having spent some time with Adam Boltwood, I don't think he could hurt a fly. So maybe him, just because he'll be very gentle.
Good point. But wow, a very gentle.
You keep
person.
Chatting shit about Boltwood, he will fucking end you.
Yeah, and that is actually directly from Adam Boltwood. He just texted that to us in the group.
Gentle giant.
He is, but he will end you.
Bad penalty taker, but
definitely a spoiler. Thoughts on global warming, Chris? This one comes from LFC Joe 96.
I mean, we need to do more to fix it.
Great, brilliant. And your almond milk is helping.
Because the farming industry is one of the biggest contributors, I believe. Is that not correct?
I guess so, but then I also guess that almonds. Almonds are less inefficient than cows.
They're not in as much pain when you milk them, I think.
How do you milk an almond? We've all thought it. Chris, you're in New York at the moment, aren't you?
I am indeed.
Are you enjoying it?
I am indeed.
What kind of milk do you drink while you're in New York? Almond.
I don't really have much milk. It's not something. I don't have oatmeal when I'm here or anything like that. So yeah, it's.
What kind of breakfast do you have? What kind of? Because you and I used to have breakfast quite a lot.
Not terribly dissimilar to what you and I used to do, which was eggs on toast and then usually some sausage. Maybe a bit of green tea.
That was actually a
nice strained orange juice.
Yeah. When we lived together. I'm not going to get into that story. Have you done a front three great podcast, Secret Santa? Who got the best present? No, we haven't. But now I'm sort of inclined to, though Dave is in Manchester. Boltwood would definitely just give Ferrero Rocher. And Chris would give a present which is way too well thought out, and he'll definitely be disappointed with what he gets.
It's a signed picture of Dave.
Yeah. Who got me this? Weirdly, it was Lawrence. Is there any point in Arsenal fans campaigning for Wenger out? That one comes from Issy Savin de la Claus Nico.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's value in general. There's a general point to Arsenal fans expressing some sort of contempt or dissatisfaction with Arsene Wenger. Do I think they should go into it with the expectation that, you know, simply because they're saying it and they've been saying it for a long time, that the board should listen to them if it's not a particularly informed opinion, then no. But I think expressing your opinion in a relatively civil manner is not a thing that is a waste of time. It's something that you should do in any situation really involving an entity larger than yourself. Just do it in a respectful way and maybe, I don't know, try to put forth some sort of a cogent argument as to why.
But also understand that UFF is a bag of shit. Which football manager do you imagine is the biggest Scrooge? That one comes from Elliot Hackney, long-time listener, first-time tweeter. Clearly, he's misspell every word. Chris?
Biggest Scrooge.
Yeah. I've got to admit, you
what's our operant definition of Scrooge here? Like someone that's generally cheap around the Christmas period or someone that's just generally a dick?
Someone that could replace Sir Patrick Stewart at short notice.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Someone who's frugal, basically.
Someone tweeted back Mark Hughes, but then Mark Hughes isn't exceptionally frugal.
Tony Pulis, probably.
Yeah, Tony Pulis is my answer as well.
He reuses tea bags, I'm sure of it.
But then he's also not... he's not the kind to take money off other people. Do you know what I mean? He's not Bob Humbug.
Oh, in that case, then Sam Allardyce.
Yeah, Big Sam is sort of that level.
Nah, I feel like he's a big spender, you know?
On himself, which is what?
On a pint of wine.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Scrooge. Is Mourinho a little bit Scroogey?
Yeah, probably am as well.
A little.
No, he does a lot for charity. Did Soccer Aid and all that.
No, good point. Yeah, so he's not Scrooge. Maybe they're all just nice guys. We just have to get over it. What will you be doing during the holidays? Time with loved ones? Time alone? That's from John Shin. What's wrong, Chris?
Sounds so depressing.
Some people do like to spend Christmas alone. I'm just saying. I mean, apparently, Bielsa spends Christmas alone. Bielsa says over the holidays, just over the winter break, just sort of sits down and watches more football.
Yeah, he said 2 hours of physical exercise and then 12 hours of sped up tape.
That's a lot of masturbation. He does speed up the tapes and then he looks for the patterns. It's very sweet. Nico, what will you do?
I suddenly understand why he decided to learn to watch two screens at once.
Nico?
Time with family and friends. It's always, I think... I prefer, you know, obviously spending time with my family as opposed to anything else, because, you know, you can sit down and have a nice conversation with people that genuinely care about you. But, you know, friends are good, too.
first time
in your family.
Is the Premier League? The Premier League is ruined. Says eight. This is Derp Dip.
This was such a terrible analogy. He said Man City are the Golden State Warriors, which just isn't true.
This isn't true. Are they a Man City more? Yeah,
because it's not like Man City bought. It's not like Man City bought every good player in the Premier League, and they have all of the good players besides like one. It's not like, you know, they have a very good collection of players, and if you match that up to other teams in the Premier League, it's relatively comparable. Right now, the Golden State Warriors are head and shoulders above pretty much everyone else in the NBA, and it's relatively unfair. Manchester City are simply just a really, really good team.
It is also interesting, though, because obviously the Golden State Warriors, every other team that's been a super team that's been built, people have found ways to beat those teams or just sort of waited for that to die out. This Golden State Warriors team and dynasty will come to a close fairly soon, come the trades. And also, it does seem to be based on a good kind of basketball as well, which I guess sort of gives it an equivalent.
I don't particularly like
watching the Golden State Warriors, if I'm honest.
No, I don't either. But I think also there are parallels between this Manchester City team and maybe Pep Guardiola teams of the past and Golden State, because there are elements of this Golden State team that like involve exploiting, is maybe not the best word, but exploiting some rules of the game of basketball or rules of the game of how basketball is played, you know, using the three and how you access the three-pointer in ways that have never been seen before. And I think maybe the parallel to that would be like tactical fouling in Guardiola teams and maybe just generally the level of talent. But as far as straight, you know, one-to-one comparison between the teams, I think there are, you know, if you look at the squad for Manchester United and how the quality of players that they have, I think it's far more even than a comparison between, let's say, the Golden State Warriors and Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, although both teams are very similar to Miami in, 12, 13 or whatever, when the LeBron traded back. Yeah. How important is a left and right-footed combo in a centre-back partnership? This one, I've read this before the podcast, and I guess we can kind of finish on this one. It was quite a nice idea, because obviously the balance of a centre-back partnership, a lot of people look for a right-footer and a left-footer, or someone who's strong on the left, strong on their right. Some managers look for just two right-footed players, two left-footed players. I think for a little while Liverpool had two left-footed players, but it actually worked out quite nicely because it skewed the team in a certain direction. And obviously being left-footed as a defender is very different to being left-footed as a striker. Do you think now people look for that sort of balance?
I think whenever possible, the difficulty comes in. I don't think everyone has the financial clout to do that.
That's another 60 grand.
Benitez did make that joke fairly recently, actually, about strikers who can kick it forward costing more and all this kind of stuff. But I think if you're a national team manager, it's slightly different, obviously. Because you have like a pool of players to pick from. But I think when you're a coach just buying players in the way that they do, yeah, I think it's a little bit different then.
Nico, do you sort of see it? Do you prefer a certain kind of combo at the back? Do you take into account strong foots, weak foots? Do you ever look at that? I mean, surely there must be something to do with expected goals and left, right foot.
I mean, I think it's entirely contextual. Obviously, having a left-footed or right-footed or whatever dominant foot center back to a team that doesn't play it out of the back or doesn't use their center backs for any sort of on-ball progression isn't going to matter to that team. But to a team maybe like Manchester City, it could be a valuable thing, because in terms of verticality and vertical passing, you could have an advantage in putting a right-footed center back as a right center back and the left-footed one as a left center back and achieve some advantage in that sense. But I don't think it's a super important thing. If it's something that springs to mind is how Chelsea like to sort of format their center backs. Obviously, they enjoy a huge deal of success with the passing of someone like Cesar Azpilicueta, but there is a direct disadvantage to playing him as the center back, which they often suffer from, which is his lack of ability to compete aerially. I mean, that's what Tottenham essentially tried to focus on, is trying to get Dele Alli in the space that he's supposed to cover and deliver aerial balls that he can get on the end of, and Cesar Azpilicueta cannot. So, I mean, not that that has much to do with the left-footed or right-footed question, but I think, you know, there is an advantage you can have if the coach realizes that and implements some sort of strategy to accentuate that quality. But as far as like, oh, we're building this team, do we need to have a left-footed and right-footed center back? I don't think it's a huge issue.
Yeah, I think at times it can be in other FIFA, things like that. Elsewhere, unsure. Let us know who your favourite centre-back pairing is ever, and who you would like to pair up. Definitely Sami Hubier and someone. I hope he got a little slow. Yeah, Sami Hubier and someone brings just a very sure back line. Not sure he'd survive in the modern game, but back then he was good. It's been good to have you guys. See you early next week, Monday, probably for the odd review. If you want to hear us cover anything over the weekend, tweet us at the front three. You find Kristen at K Hennage. Chris, it's been good to have you.
Nice to be here.
Or you can find Nico, Nico underscore Morales.
Underscore O Morales.
O Morales. I always get that wrong. Always get it wrong. And do I wrongly call you Nico?
No. That's, you can call me that.
My name. Although you do, it says Nick on your screen name on Skype.
Yeah, I mean, you know, American people, they couldn't comprehend that that was my name. So for a long time, I just went by Nick because they would just look at me weird when I said Nico. So, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Speak to a lot of people from Alabama.
Lately, yeah, I'm real proud of them. We beat the pedophile.
Yes, although that's obviously not a phrase that you often want to have to hear. It's been good to have you guys on this week's podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for your questions as well. If you have voted politically, well done. You've taken part. And that's a good start. We will see you guys after the weekend on Monday. Remember, global warming is important. And we will look into it at some point on this podcast. But until then, have a good weekend. Enjoy your football. And this was the front three.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.